You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of May 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, live from Studio One in London with me, Chloe Potter. Coming up in the next 60 minutes, a turning point in the history of space travel, as a private spacecraft attempts to dock with the International Space Station for the first time, we find out what this monumental moment means for the future of space exploration. Monocle 24's news editor Tom Edwards has a play at London's Chelsea Flower Show and their answer to the no man's land between North and South Korea, as bizarre as it sounds, but unexpectedly beautiful. We also head to Tokyo and discover that no design detail has been overlooked in the creation of Skytree, the world's second tallest man-made structure.
He essentially wanted the sky and the tree of the structure's name to be reflected in the color palette of the uniforms. And what he's produced, they look classic and they're very modern.
Also, the enduring magic and appeal of fairy tales. We ask a world expert why we're all so hooked. And as if all that wasn't enough, we also pop over to Luxembourg to find out why a Miss Portugal contest is the hottest ticket in town. Plus, some great music for you too. So plenty to look forward to coming up on Midori House here on Monocle 24. But first, let's catch up on the headlines with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. European Central Bank President Mario Draghi has called on governments to take a courageous leap of political imagination to safeguard the future of the Eurozone. In a speech in Rome, Draghi said it would take time for the full benefits of the ECB's cheap three-year loans to banks to be seen, and now the onus was on banks, and especially governments, to take their own decisive action. He spoke after European Union leaders gathered this week to try to find common ground on how to boost the region's stagnant economy, with the talks overshadowed by the issue of whether debt-stricken Greece will manage to stay in the Eurozone. The British Deputy Prime Minister Nick Clegg has said that Greece possibly leaving the Eurozone should not be seen as an instant relief for the current crisis.
If any member country were to choose to leave, it would have a very unpredictable knock-on effect, not only on members of the Eurozone, but on the European Union as a whole, including Britain, and indeed on the global economy.
Egyptians from all walks of life are voting on the second day of the nation's presidential election, in which they can choose their leader freely for the first time in history. The vote marks a crucial stage in a turbulent army-led transition racked by protests, violence and political disputes. However, Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei, once tipped to be president, said today that the ongoing Egyptian presidential election was not held on a level playing field.
By voting or by participating in the process or by running for that process, I'm giving illegitimacy to a process that has a lot of pitfalls. I'll wait for the next election when we hopefully have a level playing field, and I feel comfortable that this is really the good first step toward a genuine democracy.
A Bahraini court has sentenced Zainab El-Khawaja, the daughter of a prominent imprisoned opposition activist, to 1 month in jail for trying to organise an anti-government protest. Khawaja, the daughter of Abdelhadi El-Khawaja, who's been on hunger strike for more than 3 months, was arrested a month ago for trying to stage a protest in the capital Manama during Bahrain's Formula One Grand Prix. Police detained up to 35 people in Baku today at an opposition protest staged in the Azeri capital just days before it hosts the Eurovision Song Contest final. Amnesty International has said that with the 57th annual Eurovision Song Contest underway in Baku, the event should be enjoyed, but should also offer the chance to draw attention to what it sees as the country's poor human rights record. Amnesty's Deputy Director for Central Asia is John Dalhuizen.
Amnesty International has long been campaigning on serious human rights violations in Azerbaijan, a stern crackdown on freedom of expression, dissent, NGOs, critical journalists, in fact anyone who criticises the Aliyev regime too strongly. And we've seen this continue right up until the Eurovision Song Contest.
The ASEAN Secretary General Surin Putsuan has said Burma's lack of infrastructure is crippling its potential to attract international investors. Last year, a five-decade-old military junta made way for a reformist quasi-civilian government. Demonstrations have taken place in several towns this week, including the commercial capital Yangon, as citizens test the limit of democratic change, leaving the authorities struggling to respond. But Putsuan says Burma's authorities need to keep calm and should view the protests as a natural stage in a transition from military rule to democracy.
The space must be open for them, the opportunities must be given, and their voice and their grievances must be heard.
And Italy, Europe's biggest maker of gold jewellery, is set to be a leading global supplier of recycled bullion in the next few years as the economic crisis and high metal prices push Italians to sell their family jewels. Italy emerged in 2011 as the world's third largest source of gold scrap, with 116 tonnes of recycled gold behind the United States and China. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. It's 6 minutes past the hour. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Essa Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 har vært, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 er jo også.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The
Pro Pajalavet.
Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Tomorrow is being called the Day of Truth for Dragon, the private spacecraft that's hurtling from Earth on a record-setting journey to the International Space Station. Dragon is operated by Space Exploration Technologies Corp, or SpaceX, and it's the first private spacecraft to attempt to reach the $100 billion research lab, which is operated by a coalition of five international space agencies. The mission is an historic one for the evolving industry of commercial space flight. And to give us a sense of what to expect and the significance of the mission, we're joined now by Clara Moskowitz, the Assistant Managing Editor of Space.com, which has been giving full coverage to Dragon's progress. A warm welcome to you, Clara.
Thank you.
I'd like to kick off by asking exactly what's going to happen tomorrow. Dragon's going to fly near the space station, isn't it? And if all goes well, astronauts in the station are going to try and grab it and help it to dock. Is that right?
That's right. This capsule has no people on it right now, and so it's not going to take the docking on all by itself, but it's going to approach the station in a series of small maneuvers, getting closer and closer with a sort of go-no-go pole in mission control in between each one to make sure everything is safe, everything's going smoothly. And, you know, at the final point, if it gets up to about 10 meters, then astronauts inside the station will grab onto it and basically attach it by hand to the space station.
Just how significant is this? Dragon, as you say, is an unmanned space capsule. It's got food and clothes and experiments and things on it. But how long before we see a privately funded manned vessel, do you think?
Well, SpaceX officials are saying that 2015 is their goal to turn Dragon into a manned vehicle. And the capsule itself doesn't need major modifications to carry people. Basically, the biggest thing it needs is a launch escape system in case anything goes wrong during liftoff. So, you know, it really could be soon, and so far this mission is going super smoothly. So, you know, it seems like everything's going according to plan.
2015 doesn't sound long away at all, does it? I read that President Obama phoned the founder of SpaceX, the billionaire tech entrepreneur Elon Musk, to give his personal congratulations. That says a lot, doesn't it?
It does. And this whole plan for NASA to partner with commercial space is a big push of the Obama administration's, because the space shuttle's retired after 30 years and the United States was left without a way to get anything into orbit. And the Obama administration really pushed this new partnership to urge the commercial industry to kind of step in and fill that gap. so that NASA can actually work on doing newer, harder things like going to asteroids and Mars.
So this is really about government funding disappearing and private investment being the only way there can be a future for space exploration?
In a way, I mean, we can't do everything at once funded by the government. So if the government is going to continue building vehicles to go to Earth orbit, it's really never going to be able to do anything else. It's just too expensive. And the way that NASA administrators are putting it is that basically the industry has matured to a point where it's the natural time for them to take on this larger responsibility. That, you know, getting to Earth orbit, it's very difficult, but it's understandable. We kind of know how to do it. It's time for the government to start moving on to bigger, harder things.
So what's the exact business model of SpaceX going to be? How is that relationship with the government-run space programs working in practice?
Yeah, SpaceX has an interesting arrangement. So NASA is funding a lot of the development of Dragon, but certainly not all of it. As you mentioned, the billionaire founder Elon Musk has put quite a bit of his own funds into getting the company off the ground. But their business model is really to use the Falcon 9 rocket, which is the thing that launched Dragon, to also launch commercial satellites. And they're going to launch communication satellites. They want to take up astronauts for countries that don't have their own space programs. And eventually they want to take up space tourists and scientists.
So they're trying to create a viable space exploration business that will self-fund ultimately.
Exactly. They say that, you know, they're not going to stand on any one tier, but rather they're going to have multiple services that Dragon and Falcon 9 can perform. And they really believe the market is out there once they show that this service is safe and reliable and affordable, because what they're doing is aimed to be much, much cheaper than the same mission done on a government cost.
And if all goes well on this mission and with the docking tomorrow, do you expect other players to enter the commercial space field to rival SpaceX? Do they have a monopoly at the moment? I mean, presumably there's a gigantic barrier to entry given the high costs involved, although there are enthusiasts among billionaires out there like Richard Branson.
Yeah, that's right. SpaceX is definitely the leader, the front runner, but they are not the only game in town, for sure. So, in fact, the program that is funding this current test flight for SpaceX is also funding another company called Orbital Sciences Corporation, and they have a contract to fly delivery services to the space station as well. They're supposed to launch their first test flight later this year. So they really could be, you know, another big player very soon. They're just a little bit behind SpaceX. And there's even more companies that are working on the commercial crew competition, including Boeing and many others. So you could see a number of players.
The question everyone will want to know, you mentioned 2015 for a manned version of this vessel. That's the expectation. But you also mentioned space tourism. For all those enthusiasts out there who are desperate to get their hands on a ticket before their demise, how far off is that realistically?
You know, it's hard to say, but if you ask somebody at SpaceX, they'd say, you know, it's going to be in this decade. Because
wow.
Once they start flying people, if they really do that by 2015, then there's no reason they can't really ramp up their flights quite quickly. And there's already a waiting list of people who have the millions of dollars necessary and want to pay their own way into space. A number of people have done it on Russian spacecraft, and SpaceX's version is supposed to be much cheaper, and there's quite a lot of people, I think, who would be willing to pay for that.
Presumably, in terms of preparation for going into space, that involves lengthy training. It's not going to be a case of kind of budget space travel and just hopping on to see a view of Mars.
That's definitely true, yes. The space tourists that have gone up with Russia have spent months living in Russia training with their professional astronauts. And I think that that's really not going to change significantly. You know, there's a lot of physical risk and a lot of things that you need to know to sort of pull your own weight on a space mission. So, but, you know, the kind of people that can afford the million-dollar ticket maybe can afford to take 6 months off to train for such a mission, too.
That's very true. Clara McCowitz from space.com. Fascinating stuff. And we'll all be watching closely tomorrow and keeping our fingers crossed. Thanks so much for talking to us.
Apollo 6, train 2, Brooklyn Bridge, City Hall, approaching the station. The Urbanist is the show about the cities we live in. From mayors to street sweepers, from the CBD to the suburbs, this is the show that takes you to the heart of your metropolis. Join me, Andrew Tuck, as we speak to the planners, thinkers, and politicians changing the urban world. The latest episode of The Urbanist is a survey of the New Cities Summit in Paris, with a bit of an infrastructure focus. We start with Anil Menon of Cisco, who we asked to define that much bandied about, but often meaningless phrase, smart cities. Then we catch up with Fahd al-Rashid from the King Abdullah Economic City to find out about that metropolis rising from the Saudi sands.
We want to make it a service hub for all of these containers that pass through. It's actually one of the busiest shipping traffic lines in the world.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24. Every Saturday at midday in London, join our editors on Monocle 24 for The Review. We take you on a tour of three bookshops in three cities to hear what's flying off the shelves. We listen to some top tracks with a music aficionado from a different region. And we review a stack of our favourite new magazines each week too. That's The Review, the perfect way to start your weekend, here on Monocle 24.
You're listening to Midori House, and now it's time for some music. This is Basic Space by the XX. That was the XX with Basic Space. You're listening to Midori House. Now, turning to one of the highlights of the social calendar here in England, the globally renowned Chelsea Flower Show, long the stomping ground of Pimm's drinking traditionalists. In its more recent history, the five-day gardening show has made real inroads at bringing the cutting edge of horticultural design to the masses. Among the exhibits this year is an 80-foot magical tower garden, complete with helter-skelter, and unexpectedly, a perfectly pitched evocation of the no-man's land between North and South Korea. Monocle's news editor Tom Edwards went to have an explore.
The Chelsea Flower Show is Britain's most prestigious gardening event. This celebration of all things floral is organised by the Royal Horticultural Society and has taken place in the grounds of the Royal Hospital in Chelsea, West London, for the last 99 years. The royal family attends the opening each year, and more than 500 exhibitors showcase the best of British blooms. Chelsea is famous for its perfectly manicured lawns and precise planting. But this year, something a little different is making the headlines. Walking into the garden amongst the shrubs and a stream running by, there's a pathway that winds through the garden. And the path is actually formed from buttons, bullet cases, and strewn amongst the plants is all sort of the detritus of war and divided society. So there's old missile casings, old tin helmets, and even a feature which is thousands of dog tags, the military identity tags, that actually form one part of a feature in the corner of the garden.
The DMZ Forbidden Garden has been created to commemorate the 60th anniversary of the Korean conflict. It features many of the indigenous plants that have thrived in the sanctuary of the DMZ, the demilitarized zone between North and South Korea, that runs along the 38th parallel.
So basically there's a barbed wire running through the garden and there's a fence that separates one side to another.
Jason Su is the translator for the garden's Korean designer, Jihai Huang.
However, there's a little stream of water running along the heart of the garden, running just beneath the fence. And the artists try to portray that the nature, the power of nature, cannot be stopped, even though mankind has placed a boundary kind of in between the two borders.
I'm just about to scale the ladder up to the lookout point in this heart of the demilitarized zone garden, so watch out below. I'm heading up. We're standing at the top of the lookout tower in the middle of the demilitarized zone garden. Quite an amazing view. Most of the flora is the same kind of flora that you would find apparently growing wild in the DMZ, and they've had to carefully tend to these flowers at a secret location here to grow them because they grow nowhere else other than in that demilitarized zone.
Safely back at ground level, the garden's designer, Ji Hai Huang, explains how the idea came about.
She actually travelled to the DMZ area to study the different plantations that exist in the area, and she came back fully inspired to create this garden that you see here today. 60 years ago, the DMZ area, the demilitarized zone area, was devastated due to the war. But over 60 years, the nature has learned to heal itself, you know, the natural powers of restoration, if you like. So she wants to stress the fact that even though once it was a devastated area, now it has become one of the most beautiful gardens in the world.
How difficult is it to capture that kind of quality, that wildness?
A person is only able to show so much of the DMZ garden that, you know, she only feels that this is a proportion of how beautiful the DMZ garden actually is. And also the level of surveillance between the two borders are very severe. As you can see, some of the features around this garden actually derives from some of the actual features that exist in those areas. The actual leg structures of this watchtower has been derived from the bridge called the Freedom Bridge, and it is used for both south and the north to exchange prisoners with one another.
Sort of on that theme, obviously a garden, plants, it's very much about rebirth, starting new. It was one of the real attractions of having the garden like this, to show the promise that exists for Korea, for the region.
We hope, yes. Mm-hmm.
It's a new beginning, but also she wants to stress that we are separated due to the conflicts of two borders, but she wants to stress that because of the conflict we are separated, but the nature kind of heals, as it has healed the land, it kind of heals the tension between the two borders into a new way, hopefully. Some of the comments that we received from the general public was really amazing. Some of them have been coming here over 30 years, you know, and they've been telling us that they've never seen a garden as moving as this. Of course, they've seen pretty gardens, you know, ones that are very beautiful and kind of plastic perfect. But this garden, to them, seemed more natural and more organic, as if this has been here for over 60 years.
Last year and on previous years, we've had organized tours where people have gone off and looked around the gardens with somebody telling them what happens. And what basically happens is it's like trying to organize a herd of spiders.
Next door to the DMZ garden, the Royal Horticultural Society's secret garden party is in full swing. Visitors to the show are apparently unperturbed by the powerful political message of the garden, despite the stark contrast with its genteel surroundings. Stephen Bennett, the show's director, explains.
It is actually extremely unusual in a number of ways. First of all, as you say, it's got quite a strong political message. It's a very powerful emotional story threading through it. Horticulturally, it's very unusual because Chelsea is famous for having well-manicured, beautifully trimmed, perfectly symmetrical gardens. What these guys have done is create a bit of a wilderness, and it's much harder, much, much harder horticulturally. The detail is quite staggering. They've had less than 3 weeks to do that, and it looks like it's been there for 35 years. It's quite astonishing.
What have the other sort of exhibitors, what kind of feedback have you got from them in terms of how they feel it's sat amongst the rest of the exhibitions here?
The other designers have been very moved and full of admiration for the ingenuity and creativity and sheer skill that's gone into creating that. I mean, it is staggering. It's amazing, even by Chelsea standards.
And do you think it signals maybe a shift in what we can perhaps expect here going forwards at Chelsea? Will we see some more experimental work, or do you think it'll be hard to break with a lot of those well-established traditions?
Oh, we love breaking with well-established traditions. I hope it does break a few moulds. Really difficult to predict what's going to happen next year or in the future, but I'm very sure that the DMZ Garden will get people thinking and inspire talented people to think about a new and different way of illustrating a story to get a message across.
Certainly the Garden appears to have secured critical as well as popular approval, being awarded the event's prestigious gold medal. And you still have the opportunity to judge it for yourself. The Chelsea Flower Show runs until Saturday. For Monocle in London, I'm Tom Edwards.
That was Tom enjoying himself at London's Chelsea Flower Show. You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24.
Vous écoutez Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
Das ist Monocle 24.
En Monocle 24 Tagat, ja.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24 ei joukossa.
Tämä on Monocle 24.
The Proper Jalavet. Monocle 24.
Esto es Monocle 24.
Aftoimet on Monocle 24.
Tähän on Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
In the next half an hour on Midori House, we'll be crossing over to Tokyo to find out about Japan's new point of national pride, the world's second tallest man-made structure, the poetically named tower, Sky Tree. We'll discover why it is that we find fairy tales so endlessly fascinating, and we'll head to Luxembourg to get a bit of Portuguese flavour. But first, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Chloe. The European Central Bank President Mario Draghi has called on governments to take a courageous leap of political imagination to safeguard the future of the Eurozone. Disappointing Eurozone data has seen a host of top banks and economists firm up forecasts for the European Central Bank to cut interest rates below 1%. For the first time in its history in the next few months. Iran and world powers will meet in Moscow on June the 18th for more talks to try to solve a long-standing dispute about the Iranian nuclear energy programme. Egyptians from all walks of life are voting on the second day of the nation's presidential election, but the Nobel Peace Prize winner Mohamed El-Baradei said the election was not held on a level playing field. A Bahraini court has sentenced Zainab El-Khawaja, the daughter of a prominent imprisoned opposition activist, to 1 month in jail for trying to organise an anti-government protest. Police detained up to 35 people in Baku today at an opposition protest staged in the Azeri capital just 2 days before it hosts the Eurovision Song Contest final. The ASEAN Secretary-General has said Burma's lack of infrastructure is crippling its potential to attract international investors. Italy, Europe's biggest maker of gold jewellery, is set to be a leading global supplier of recycled bullion in the next few years as the economic crisis and high metal prices push Italians to sell their family jewels. And the Space Exploration Technologies, or SpaceX Dragon spaceship, flew smoothly through a practice drive by the International Space Station today, clearing the way for it to become the first private vessel to reach the orbital outpost. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thanks very much, Nick. Now, every day this week on Midori House, we've been chatting with the writers and editors behind the stories featured in the latest edition of Monocle magazine, which is now available at newsstands around the world. And today, we headed to Tokyo, where Monocle's Asia editor-at-large, Kenji Hall, has been among the lucky first to experience the world's second tallest man-made structure. The poetically named Sky Tree puts Japan firmly on the branded architecture map, alongside the UAE's Burj Khalifa in Dubai and London's Gherkin and the hotly anticipated Shard. Skytree has been 7 years in the building and planning. So I started by asking Kenji, has it been worth the wait?
I think it has. I think it's a great time for Japan to be
building a structure like this because it draws a lot of attention to Japanese manufacturing and Japanese technology. A lot of that know-how went into building this thing, which is 634 meters tall. It's the second tallest building in the world, the tallest freestanding structure tower in the world. And, you know, when you look at the shops that are inside the complex at the base of the tower, those shops also reflect this sort of all-Japan effort. So I went on day two, the day after the complex actually opened to the public. Mm-hmm. It opened on Tuesday, and I went on Wednesday. On Tuesday, the first day, opening day, it was a heavy downpour here in Tokyo. So not as many people turned out as, you know, the property developers had expected. When I went, it was a beautiful, warm, sunny day. The crowds were really thick. Inside the shopping area, there were so many people that you had to shuffle. It's really drawn a lot of attention domestically, and I expect that a lot of tourists from overseas will be coming to check it out as well.
Rather inspirationally, to go back to the beginning of the Sky Tree's birth as an idea, if you like, and a sculptor was involved initially, wasn't he?
That's right. His name was Kichi Sumikawa, and he joined the project back in 2006. This is back at a time when, you know, they were thinking of just putting an ordinary tower up. And when they brought him on board, he was the one who prodded them to try to think outside the box a little bit. He wanted them to create something a little more artful than usual. And, you know, the developer is actually a railway operator. It's Tobu. And they're not known for being especially innovative. The tower itself is built on an old railway yard. And so they were just thinking of putting up a really, really tall structure and you know, developing the property around it. Mm. And what he was basically saying is, look, this is an effort, this is an opportunity for us to create something that will attract a lot of attention to Japan and to Japanese manufacturing. But it's not just about the nuts and bolts. We also should be putting up something really beautiful. And so I think he had a lot to do with, he and the architect, Tadao Ando, had a lot to do with the overall look and feel of the tower.
So it's not only beautiful. Is it beautiful, Kenji?
I think it is. It's striking. I mean, I was going to the airport just last week to go to Seoul. And on my way, you know, I was on the train and I glanced to my left. And, you know, you can see it in the distance. Even on a not-so-clear day, it's there. It's striking. You know, juts out between the buildings. It's definitely something. It's an additional trademark to Tokyo skyline. And I think they were right in hiring both Tadao Ando and Kichi Sumikawa for help in designing it.
And it's set to become a real point of national pride. It really was a team effort, wasn't it? Small family businesses and national industries involved across the whole spectrum.
Absolutely. You had companies as big as YKK and Hitachi doing things like the elevators and a glass-encased walkway up on the observatory deck. You had companies like Mitsubishi Heavy Industries. These are major, major Japanese companies. Panasonic did the LED lighting. But you also had these small factories, you know, of 100 or 200 people that contributed to the effort because the larger companies oftentimes don't have the know-how to do something very specialized. And that's something they left to smaller companies. So, you know, I spoke with a company called Tomita Seisakusho, which is in Matsudo City. And it's led by a 52-year-old who's the third generation in his family to run the business. And they basically were able to, they have the huge metal presses that were needed to turn metal planks into 2-meter-wide steel tubes. That was something that not even JFE Steel, which is Japan's largest steel company, had to know how to do. Mm. So you really, really had to tap into this deep reservoir of Japanese manufacturing know-how by going all the way to the smallest factories. And I think that's a really interesting point that a lot of people probably don't know about.
And it's clearly a feat of manufacturing ingenuity. there were lots of unique challenges involved building something of this height in one of the world's busiest cities, weren't there?
That's right. They're building on such a small plot of land. And, you know, I mean, when you enter the complex, it's actually a pretty spacious complex. But, you know, when you're building something that tall, 634 meters tall, you really need a lot of space to store things like, you know, the tubes that are going to be brought onto the property and then hoisted up and welded into place. But they didn't have that luxury, and so they had to really tap into another piece of you know, Japanese manufacturing know-how, and that was the just-in-time manufacturing that Toyota actually popularized. And so what they did was they figured out when certain pieces would be needed, and like clockwork, essentially trucks were bringing pieces as those pieces were needed to be hoisted into place. So you know, there was so much of what Japanese companies and Japanese manufacturers do well being put to use in building this tower.
Impressive stuff. Nothing like this had ever been attempted before in Japan, had it? But they did borrow from ancient techniques.
That's right. So the sculpture, the sculptor Kichi Sumikawa, when he was brought on, he looked back at history and tried to figure out what types of towers Japan had built, you know, thousands of years ago. And he came upon a structure that was built, you know, the oldest standing wooden structure is a five-tiered pagoda that was built 1,400 years ago.
Mm.
That structure has lasted through typhoons, through major storms, through major earthquakes. And so he had this idea that, you know, if you build a structure that has a couple of different pieces to it that move independently, they'll be able to absorb a lot of the shock that you would get from heavy winds or from, you know, the earth shaking. So that know-how was actually applied again to this tower. And it wasn't only that. You know, they actually sent up balloons to check wind speeds.
Mm.
They did numerous computer simulations to look at what would happen if there were a massive earthquake to strike Tokyo, you know, because obviously the structure has to withstand that kind of shaking.
Absolutely. There must have been a huge collective sigh of relief when it withstood the magnitude 9 quake last year.
Absolutely. The tower was almost finished. They had yet to lift the antenna into place. And that's when the magnitude 9 quake struck off Japan's Pacific coast. And yet, you know, and I've seen footage of how much the tower shook. I believe it swayed 6 meters to each side, and there were workers up top, you know, at the time involved in the construction. And so, and yet, there was no damage to the tower. So that was a huge relief, I think, for the engineers and the architects and the work crews involved.
Incredible. Kenji, tell us, who's visiting? You mentioned shopping. What kind of businesses are there? What are the hopes for the future of this building? Do they want it to be a kind of buzzy public arena?
It already is. It already is. So, as I mentioned before, the shops reflect this kind of all Japan side. When I went there, I counted about 300 shops in total. Shops, cafes, restaurants galore. Zara is there, Onitsuka Tiger, which is a shoe brand put out by ASICS, Diesel, Samantha Tavassa. Mm-hmm. There's a planetarium, there's an aquarium. I checked out United Arrows, which is a fashion retailer of men's and women's wear. And the manager there mentioned that being in the complex gave them this rare chance to really extend their reach beyond the fashionable folks who would normally seek out their shops. And the same goes for a small company called Stetico, which sells these knee-length cotton pants that are traditionally worn under a kimono. They, too, mm-hmm. were in the complex as a way of, you know, essentially selling themselves to a broader sort of public.
And, Kenji, there's been an extraordinary attention to design detail, hasn't there? Right down to the uniforms that the staff have been issued with.
Absolutely. So the uniforms were designed by a man named Akira Minagawa. He's a Tokyo-based designer And his label, Mina Perhonen, is actually known for using original textiles. And, you know, what he told us was that he wanted to use Japanese textiles, again, the theme of an sort of all Japan tower and all Japan uniform running through everything in the tower. He essentially wanted the sky and the tree of the structure's name to be reflected in the color palette of the uniforms. And what he's produced are these really, they look classic and they're very modern. I remember when I was in the tower and I saw the cafe uniforms. The cafe uniforms would normally just be, you know, a white shirt and blue pants. But he's done this really interesting thing with the apron, where the apron buttons to the shirt. You know, it doesn't tie into place. It actually sort of buttons into place on the uniform. And it's a really sort of sharp look that is original, and it's beautifully done.
A true building of the future there. That was Monocle's Asia Editor-at-Large, Kenji Hall, telling us all about Tokyo's new tower, Skytree. Now, an item I've been particularly looking forward to, fairy tales. Excuse me, the magical stories are experiencing a very grown-up resurgence at the moment, with, for example, numerous takes on classics like Snow White and Little Red Riding Hood being turned into blockbuster films. We're joined now by one of the world's most prolific authors of fairy tale and folklore studies, the literary scholar Jack Zipes. A very warm welcome to Monocle 24, Professor. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
Now, in writing your most recent book, The Irresistible Fairy Tale, A Cultural and Social History of a Genre, you attempted to discover where these wonderful stories originated. And what did you discover?
Well, the tales definitely originated in some type of oral tradition in pagan times. It's impossible to really know exactly when they originated, but we do know that as soon as people began speaking, they began telling stories and gossiping and providing information in very brief tales. And they must have also added, as societies developed, magical elements that embroidered the tales, made the tales more exciting. And also, to a certain extent, may have also been based on incidents that happened that they couldn't explain to themselves. So there is no exact date with regard to when fairy tales originated, but we do know that they evolved slowly. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until, let us say, the Greco-Roman times, when myths were being told and actually written down, because we started to have languages and also grammars. It wasn't until that time that really, I would say, through myths, that the fairy tales began to evolve separately as a genre, particularly during the early middle medieval period.
One of the most incredible things about fairy tales is their presence the world over. Is it true that essentially the same stories cropped up simultaneously in very different cultures? So there's an Eskimo take on Little Red Riding Hood, as well as an Italian version, a French, a German take. How do you explain that? And is that actually true?
Yes, it is actually true. It's amazing. For instance, in the 19th century, one of the earlier studies by a woman by the name of Cox already discovered something like 1,000 different versions of Cinderella worldwide, not just in Europe, not just in England. It was a British publication. There are different explanations for the spread, for the dissemination of fairy tales. Some of the dissemination may be due to the fact that people traveled, heard stories, let us say, on their trips to the Orient, and they brought them back to Europe and retold them and refashioned them, and then they were picked up by other storytellers. There's a new article that I read on street singers in Italy. who were prevalent in there were also troubadours and fools who told stories at court. So there were different very concrete ways that tales were spread. I also tend to think when we have no proof whatsoever of the same tale, let's say Cinderella, Little Red Riding Hood, and some of the other major tales, when we have no proof that they were told in a particular country or carried from one country to another, that the experiences that we have as human beings are such that that is our genome, the human genome is such that we respond to our environment and to changes in our environment and to relations among ourselves in very similar ways, so that it is not by chance that we begin telling stories that are different but similar and can be found throughout the world.
Professor, you also set out to unravel why it is that we're so endlessly and universally, as you say, fascinated with these seemingly childish stories. Why is it that they have such enduring appeal? And why is it that some stories stick and others fade away?
Right. I've tried to develop a somewhat controversial theory. Actually, I'm not the one who started all this controversy. It was Richard Dawkins in his book, The Selfish Gene, which is a wonderful book that came out in 1976. And in the final chapter of that book, he developed this notion that not only do we have genes in our system, but we have memes, M-E-M-E, and these, M-E-M-E-S,
yes.
And these memes are actually a cultural units of information that we retain in modules in our brain, and that we store them because they're very relevant to the ways that we as humans adapt to our environments. And we recall these bits of information, which can be anything from a song, a rhyme, a story, a particular color, or an expression. We store them because they are so vital and salient and relevant to the way we interact with other human beings. And so I've tried to develop to explain that, let us take the story of Little Red Riding Hood. Most people would not really look upon it as a story of rape or a story of violation. But it is. It's a story about a little girl who is, the wolf is obviously a man, or was a werewolf in some of the original stories. And it's a story about how a girl is raped or violated, her grandmother as well, by a man, and who's responsible for this. And because this story, because first of all, rape and violation have unfortunately not gone away in our contemporary world, this particular story, because it's been honed in such an amazing symbolic way, stays with us, and we recall it to tell and retell and revisit what the problems are with regard to rape in our society.
Professor, that theory about Little Red Riding Hood was particularly brought out in the 1960s, a sort of feminist take on Little Red Riding Hood. And fairy tales do appear to be a very malleable genre that can sort of take on the cultural nuances of a particular era of history, as you explained there. Hence, the silent female characters in The Brothers Grimm, for example. How do you think our own versions, like the new Snow White films, will be regarded? And what will they reveal about our own society?
I have a fairly low opinion of most of the fairy tale films, although there are some excellent ones. But let us say the two that I've seen recently, the Red Riding Hood by directed by Catherine Hardwicke, and then Mirror Mirror, directed by the Tarsem Singh. Both of these films I find are kitschy. Are frivolous, stupid, and filled with bad acting and overdramatic scenes that really are meaningless. Nevertheless, despite my critique of these films, they indicate that we are still dealing with, you know, particular problems, and that filmmakers choose the fairy tale because of the fact that it is so pervasive in our lives.
And we universally familiar.
Yes. We don't, you know, if you turn on the TV, practically every commercial that you watch
is based on a fairy tale.
Exactly. You hit it on the nail.
Yes. Professor, in recent years, there's been some controversy over fairy tales, with some parents feeling that they're just too frightening to read to young children, and they want sort of more sanitized versions, perhaps like the films we see. What do you make of that fear?
Well, I think that parents should turn their attention to what's going on in TV or what's going on the streets. And the children nowadays are exposed to greater violence in other stories, and also through commercials, and that they should be more concerned about that than fairy tales. The fairy tales actually present alternative moral worlds that will help, or at least give children hope that there is a way to resolve the terrible conflicts that they are faced with day in, day out.
Sadly, we have to leave it there. Professor Jack Zipes, world-renowned fairy tale expert and academic, thanks so much for joining us. You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back right after this.
In Tasmania, talented craftspeople are making use of the island's natural materials to design and build furniture and ceramics. Monocle Video journalist Gabriel Lee toured the island to meet the designer makers, putting Tasmania's personality on the map.
It seemed to me that if I was going to make pots at this time and in this culture, I needed to say something about being here and now. And the way to do that was through the materials.
You can watch this and many more Monocle films, from affairs to business, culture to design, in the programs menu on monocle.com.
Now, almost 15% of the population in Luxembourg is of Portuguese origin. It's a surprisingly large number, considering the country's total population is just a little over 500,000. Miss Portugal Luxembourg is a highly anticipated event, not only within the Portuguese community itself. For an update on that event and on the upcoming royal wedding in the country that's going to happen later this year, we're joined on the line by Paula Tello Alves, a journalist who works in Contacto, a weekly newspaper catering for the Portuguese community in the tiny country of Luxembourg. Welcome, Paula.
Hello.
Thank you for joining us. Now, first off, tell us what the history of the Portuguese community in Luxembourg is.
Well, the first immigrants came to Luxembourg in 1960, and there were big waves of immigration in those days, but the waves never stopped, really, and we've experienced a new, very big wave of immigrants to Luxembourg in the last decade due to the crisis in Portugal as well. So we now amount to, I'd say it's more than 15% now. The official numbers mention 18% numbers that we got from the Portuguese consulate in Luxembourg.
And what kind of cultural impact has the Portuguese community come to have on Luxembourg? Is there evidence of Portuguese influence on the food, for example?
Definitely, and I'd say you could hardly not notice, because if you count as well the Brazilian immigrants and immigrants coming from Cape Verde, an average of 20 to 25% of people speak Portuguese. So you see it in the coffee shops, in restaurants, and as you mentioned earlier, in events that have become very, very popular, like Miss Portugal in Luxembourg.
Mm. Tell us all about that event. I understand that it's even more popular than the national contest Miss Luxembourg. So it's not just the Portuguese community who enjoy it.
Definitely, that's definitely true. Actually, the event started 13 years ago, and at the time, Luxembourg didn't organize a similar event. So there was no Miss Luxembourg,
right,
while there was a Miss Portugal in Luxembourg. And it became widely popular. It's actually followed by the main press. and it's first page every time. And even after they've, a few years ago, I can't precise how many, I'd say 3 to 4 years ago, Luxembourg decided to start their own competition. And the Portuguese won that competition recently as well, because she has dual nationality, and she had been previously as well Miss Portugal in Luxembourg. So it's definitely very popular.
And the other thing we really want to talk about with you is the royal wedding that's planned in Luxembourg later this year. How's that going down with your readers?
The Portuguese are rather conservative and very fond of the royal family, to start with, because I don't know if you know this, it's not a well-known fact, but the royal family in Luxembourg has Portuguese ancestry. So actually the mother of the current Grand Duke was the granddaughter of Portuguese king. So to start with, that makes Portuguese more interested in the royal family. And I myself, some years ago, interviewed Portuguese to find out whether they how well they knew the politicians in Luxembourg. Now, I was surprised to realize that they were more familiar with the Grand Duke Henry than with Prime Minister Jean-Claude Juncker himself. So I think it will be very popular with the Portuguese community. We recently did a feature on the couple, and we published some pictures of Stéphanie de Lannoy having her holidays in Algarve in Portugal. So
and it went down very well.
Yes, I think for various reasons it will be an event followed very
fascinating.
Closely.
Fascinating to talk to you. Thanks so much for joining us, Paula Tello Alves. That's all we've got time for today. Thanks to my producer, Daniel Giacopelli, our researcher, Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio manager, Toby Hammond. In 3 hours' time, Andrew Miller and Emma Nelson will be here with the Monocle Daily, so don't miss that. But for now, thanks for listening and goodbye.